Whoever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. My name is Melissa Carvel-Zimmer. It's my privilege to serve as the minister of this congregation. I'm joined in welcoming you this morning by Trish McLaughlin, who's serving as our worship associate this service. Sophie Smith was scheduled to help me lead the service this morning, and she has gotten quite sick and unfortunately can't be with us this morning. So we send her healing thoughts and are glad that Trish was able to join us instead. I'm also joined in welcoming this morning by Jesse Young, who is playing our hymns most Sundays for June and July, and also by a special guest musician, Matt Watroba. Many of you will recognize Matt. He's played here before, and he is also one of the co-producers of the Cuyahoga River concert series with our music director, Hal Walker. Many of you have seen him in that context, and if you haven't met him in either of those two capacities, you may well recognize his voice from his hosting of Folk Alley and the WKSU Folk Show. So we're glad to have you with us this morning. Thank you, Matt. Will turn. We gather here this morning on the cusp of the summer solstice. I light our chalice this morning with gratitude for the warm summer days and all they will bring us.
Our call to worship comes from Gordon McKeeman. We summon ourselves from the demands and the delights of the daily round, from the dirty dishes and unwaxed floors, from the unmown grass and untrimmed bushes, from all incompletenesses and not yet startednesses, from the unholy and the unresolved. We summon ourselves to attend to our vision of peace and justice, of cleanliness and health, of delight and devotion, of the lovely and the holy, of who we are and what we can do. We summon the power of tradition and the exhilaration of newness, the wisdom of the ages and the knowing of the very young. We summon beauty, eloquence, poetry, and music to be the bearers of our dreams. We would open our eyes, our ears, our minds, our hearts to the amplest dimensions of life. We rejoice in manifold promises and possibilities. Come, let us worship together.
Over the course of the summer, we take a hiatus from our formal religious education program to offer a more informal, multi-age program that generally explores a single theme. And this year, the theme that the children of the congregation will be exploring in their time together during our Sunday morning services is play. And many adult members of the congregation have been invited to come explore the spiritual dimensions of play with them. And during this time, we also take a hiatus from our usual time for all ages. Our wisdom words this morning were selected in recognition and honor of Father's Day. They're from the United States-born poet Diane Derhovanesian, who is of Armenian descent. This poem is especially for all of those of you who have lost important fathers, father figures, uncles, grandfathers, and other men in your life. It's called Shifting the Sun. When your father dies, say the Irish, you lose your umbrella against bad weather. May his son be your light, say the Armenians. When your father dies, say the Welsh, you sink a foot deeper into the earth. May his son be your light, say the Armenians. When your father dies, say the Canadians, you run out of excuses. May his son be your light, say the Armenians. When your father dies, say the Indians, he comes back as thunder. May you inherit his son, say the Armenians. When your father dies, say the Russians, he takes your childhood with him. May you inherit his light, say the Armenians. When your father dies, say the British, you join his club you vowed you wouldn't join. May you inherit his son, say the Armenians. When your father dies, say the Armenians, your son shifts forever and you walk in his light. We'll keep silence for a few moments together. Now I invite you to join with me in this prayer for Father's Day composed by a colleague, Krista Taves, and adapted just slightly. Spirit of life and love, God of grace and mercy, source of hope and healing, this is a day that is often filled with memories. Memories of our fathers, grandfathers, stepfathers, uncles, coaches, and other men who have been father figures. Memories of those still with us and of those who have passed on that fill us with gratitude and with love. Memories that can bring grief and sorrow. Some memories that bring unrest and turmoil. Some memories are good to remember, others we wish we could forget. Spirit of life, help us with our memories. And if we are called in some way to the path of forgiveness, help us walk toward that path. On this day, we would ask for blessings on the legacies that we carry from our fathers and other men, for they bear both wisdom and folly. Help us to hold these legacies gently and firmly, for they hold power and promise, and if carried wisely, can deepen our spirits and grow our capacity for giving and receiving love. On this day, we would also ask blessings on the legacies that we will leave to those who will follow us. We're all parents in some way. We are all mothers and fathers. We're all aunts and uncles and grandparents. We are role models and mentors and friends. Help us to celebrate the legacies that we are proud of and to forgive ourselves the legacies that we wish we could undo. Help us to claim the truth that we are all parents of this desperately beautiful world and its people. And each of us, may we leave this world changed, changed for the better for having been here. Amen, and blessed be. Our first reading this morning comes from Beth Schultes, who some of you may remember or have been friends with. Beth was a member of our congregation for many years. She was a poet and an artist. She had 4 academic degrees, 2 of them master's degrees. She was a seeker after wellness, and she also lived with mental illness. She was diagnosed at different points in her life with both schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. When she died, we created this little booklet of some of her art and her writings to share at her memorial service. And this poem is one of the ones we selected from her large collection of writings, and it speaks to her quest for wellness. It's called What's Going On? Walking in the woods one day, I had the weirdest experience. Every 10 feet or so, I would lose my mind. It would just be gone all of a sudden, and I would stop dead in my tracks because, after all, how far can you go without a mind? Really, think about it. The first time it happened, I barely set foot on the path when, boom, I was stymied by a tree root in my way. Tripping over it, I felt something jar loose inside. For the longest time, I couldn't figure out what happened, but I couldn't move forward, and I felt rooted to the spot. I kept turning around and around, and I must have resembled a slothful, whirling dervish when I saw it. It was my mind lying on the ground. It had kind of spilled out and was wound tightly like a grapevine, curvaceous-like around a long, straight, and narrow branch. I was shocked and kind of curious and wasn't sure what to do as it was so close to that branch, but Well, there was no separating them, so I put my tightly wound mind back in its place and was able to go on my way. But again it happened, and I didn't even feel it this time and only noticed because my legs stopped moving and I couldn't walk anymore. I figured it got lost again, and sure enough, it was behind me, just lying there, kind of looking silly on the ground, still wrapped around that somewhat sleekest branch, so I grabbed it and stowed it away. But a few feet later, I was dazed once more. And as a slow-witted as I am, with a mind without a mind, you can imagine what happens when it gets lost. This time, I frantically began searching for it, afraid I wouldn't find it this time. But it started squeaking, so I think it was trying to tell me what I don't know. Funny thing is, I only lost my mind when no one else was around, which I can't understand. Because whenever someone else appeared on the path, it was perfectly fine. But as soon as I was alone, my mind would wander off. And well, then I couldn't find it right away. But it became such a habit that I grew less and less frantic about it over time. As I walked the woods, I found that losing your mind, far from being scary, is probably most edifying to the spirit as it tries to talk to the trees, which we all know the mind can only pretend to do. For it's the spirit that connects us, that is our bond of communication with all that is around us. For it is the spirit that vibrates with the wind through the branches of the trees, causing them maybe, just maybe, their own small vibration.
Patty Duke is an award-winning actress who was diagnosed with what is now called bipolar disorder in 1982. In addition to continuing with her acting work, Duke has become a spokeswoman for many mental health organizations in an effort to reduce the stigma so often associated with mental illness. This passage speaks to her efforts in that regard. There are enough people out there who still equate mental illness with damaged goods that cannot be fixed. We make jokes about being crazy. It's part of our lexicon. Someone acts strangely, they're crazy. They have the scarlet letter on them, and that is that. I emphasize that people should not be ashamed of mental illness, that they don't need to talk about it in hushed, conspiratorial tones. That's why I think it's important for people who are well known to speak out and reinforce for those who don't have famous names that they are part of a club that is a healthy one, or can be.
So if you came in through Fessenden Hall this morning, you will have noticed the happiness flag we made last Sunday during our service outdoors at Plum Creek Park. It's now hanging in Fessenden Hall. If you didn't yet have an opportunity to make a panel for the flag with your own wish or prayer for happiness for yourself or other people, it isn't too late. We have all the materials downstairs for your creative enjoyment. That flag, the service last week, and the one next week are all part of our exploration of the theme of happiness. Last Sunday, I shared some insights from the vast body of happiness research that's been conducted in recent years. I talked about the idea that our conceptions of happiness grow and change as we grow and change, and the observation that older people tend to define happiness differently than younger people. For most adults, happiness is best described as a kind of contentedness, a sense of well-being. Of course, that isn't a permanent state, but one to which many of us aspire, including people living with mental illness. I wanted to explore the connections between happiness and mental illness, between mental illness and well-being this morning, because it's something that touches the lives of so many of us, but about which we do not often speak. Patty Duke and many others have spoken about the stigma still associated with mental illness. That stigma is a big part of what makes it difficult for us to have open and honest conversations. Beth Schultes, whose poem I shared with you, addressed the impact of that stigma in an article that she wrote for a journal, the Psychiatric Rehabilitation Skills Journal. Her article was called Managing Mental Illness. I understand the stigma, she writes. When I see someone worse off than myself, who can't function at all or who doesn't know how to be with people socially, then I too feel that discomfort, that need to distance. It's frightening to see because it's difficult to comprehend to know that there but for the grace of God go I. What is it, though, that's so hard to see? Is it the illness itself? Or is it the thinking or sense that somehow these people contribute to their problems? I think what is difficult is that mental illness is so unpredictable and we do not know what someone with it might do. Later in the article, she continues, I'm not always psychotic, neither am I always manic or depressed. Usually I'm pretty lively and fun to be around. But when I sense things that I cannot explain, then I am in danger of being lost, for then my fears take over. And these fears are part of mental illness, at least my mental illness. Fears from past experience that have left scars yet to heal, of trying to make it in a world with no sympathy for our sensitivities. I do know that those with mental illness live a very vulnerable existence because many of us, at least some of the time, are unable to fight for ourselves because unfortunately we're fighting ourselves inside, struggling to maintain sanity in the face of insanity. It's a wonderful article. She speaks candidly about many facets of what it's like to live with mental illness, and we have a copy of it if any of you would like to see it. I think Beth captures really well the dual struggle so many people experience in dealing with the impact of society's stigma while also dealing with the consequences of mental illness, especially when the disease is active. To understand better the scope of what we're talking about this morning, it might be helpful to take a moment to define our terms. Barbara Myers is a Unitarian Universalist minister who has a specialized community ministry and mental health ministry. She explains that there's a continuum of mental health. And at one end of the continuum, we might say someone has perfect mental health. And at the other end of the continuum, we might say someone has a severe mental disorder. Her understanding of the research is that this, where we fall on that continuum at any point in our lives is fluid, and that circumstances may mean that we kind of move back and forth at various points in our lives in response to outside events and circumstances as well as to internal factors. So part of what she emphasizes is that mental health refers to the successful performance of our lives, essentially, when we're able to engage in meaningful activities, to have meaningful relationships, to use our mental functions to get by in the world. Mental disorder refers basically to the opposite end of that continuum, when we're not able to use our mental capacities to function well in life, we're unable to maintain meaningful relationships, engage in meaningful activities, or to cope with the challenges that adversity and change bring to so many of us. But those are not fixed. They're not fixed points. That's the point that she tries to make in her work. They're not fixed. Where we are at any one point in our lives is going to change. There are several different kinds of mental disorders, including mood disorders like depression and bipolar disorder, anxiety disorders, which are probably best well known. Many people talk more openly, I think, about generalized anxiety disorders than they do some of the other mental illnesses. But anxiety disorders also include things like post-traumatic stress disorder and obsessive compulsive disorder. There are psychotic disorders, which include things like schizophrenia, personality disorders, eating disorders, and a number of other disorders usually seen first in childhood, like attention deficit hyperactive disorder. So this is when we speak about mental illness and mental disorders, we're speaking really about a very broad collection of conditions that people might experience in their lives. The research is always ongoing, and there's still debate about the best way to treat each of these illnesses. The reality of our time is that there's much greater understanding now about what mental illness is, how it typically manifests, and what kinds of resources, treatments, and supports most people experience as helpful. There's also much greater understanding about the prevalence of mental illness. The National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI, which, by the way, operates around here and has educational programs that are open to the community, is one of the leading support and advocacy organizations for people with mental illness in our country. NAMI reports that 1 in 4 adults experiences a mental health disorder in our country in any given year. of those, about 1 in 17 of those adults are experiencing a major debilitating mental illness. Among children, 1 in 10 experience a serious mental disorder. Those numbers are so significant that chances are good that if we have not experienced a mental disorder ourselves, that we love somebody who has or does. But there's good news, because with good effective treatment, between 70 and 90% of people with mental illness can have a significant reduction in their symptoms. With the right treatment, most people with mental illness can have the impact of their illness diminished and can find a satisfying measure of achievement and independence. In other words, it's very possible for most people with mental illness to find that sense of well-being that we all long to experience in our lives. The advances in understanding and treatment options we have today was impacted by many people, and amongst those is a woman who was one of our religious forebears who I'd like to tell you about. Her name was Dorothea Dix, and she lived during the 19th century. Dix was the eldest of three children born to parents who were not able to successfully navigate their own struggles in life. Her father was a lay Methodist preacher who was determined to raise his children in accordance with the strict disciplinary measures advocated amongst those in his faith community at the time. He was also an alcoholic who vacillated between periods of incapacitating drunkenness and intoxicating religious fervor. Dix's mom was a cold and reserved woman who showed precious little love or affection to her children and who experienced her own debilitation, which made it difficult for her to care for them. So just before her 13th birthday, Dorothea Dix ran away to her grandmother's house in Boston. Over the course of the next several years, she lived with a variety of relatives, moving back and forth to different relatives' homes. But all of those relatives encouraged her to put her obvious intellect to good use. So she decided that she would teach school, which is what many women who had a yearning to contribute to the world outside of their home did in her age. So she opened her first school when she was just 14 years old. She found success as a school teacher and then later as an author of children's books. As a young woman, Dix again found herself living with her grandmother in Boston. It was at that time that she began attending Unitarian churches and developing close associations with a number of well-known Unitarian ministers of the day, including William Ellery Channing, who became something of a substitute father figure for her. Channing was probably the best-known Unitarian of the time and considered by many to be the father of the nascent Unitarian movement. Dix was particularly impressed with the Unitarian emphasis on social action on behalf of disadvantaged people, and she was moved by the variety of reform efforts she saw Unitarians participating in at the time, and she felt a desire to participate in that, to participate in some kind of social action. But she mostly did that through her work with children, helping disadvantaged children. She often kept room in her schools for some children to attend for free who would not have had the means to do so otherwise. And she found that pretty satisfying, but she had the sense that there was another calling in her life, but she didn't know what it was. She found it when she was 41 years old. She found it after a period of her own struggle, which came in the form of bouts of mysterious illness that would come and leave her incapacitated and last for quite some time before they lifted. Some of her biographers say that it's likely that she probably suffered from a depressive disorder herself, and that what she was experiencing were periods of major depression, which would affect her physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, and leave her completely unable to engage with life until she kind of got through that episode and was able to emerge again. So during one period of recovery with some Unitarian friends in England, Dix began to be aware, as she was coming out of that period of time, of the reform efforts for those with mental illness in Europe. And these intrigued her, and she kind of kept them in the back of her mind. When she came back to Massachusetts, she had many Unitarian acquaintances, including lots of friends who were divinity school students, and one of those students had been randomly assigned to teach a Sunday school class in the local jail for women, and he was completely overwhelmed. He couldn't keep order, he couldn't connect with the women, he didn't know what he was doing, and so he asked her, with her vast educational experience, if she would come help him teach the Sunday school class. She did. And she was very successful teaching the class. But this is the moment where she kind of found her calling in life. As she was leaving the jail, she noticed that this particular cell didn't have any heat. And she complained to the prison officials as she was leaving that there was no heat. It was wintertime. It was freezing in there. And they said, oh, don't worry about that. And using the language of the day, they said, the prisoners in those cells are insane, and lunatics can't tell the difference between hot and cold. Dix was incensed by what she felt to be such a ridiculous statement, so she filed a petition with the local court where her claim was immediately granted. This effort was the beginning of her career as a social reformer. Her work took place both in jails and in institutions for the mentally ill. In a tour of local jails and almshouses, she learned that the insane were often lumped together with serious criminals and that those most mentally ill were often kept in chains, unable to move and often unable to have access even to toileting facilities. Shortly thereafter, she was able to visit the first mental hospital, that's what it was called in Massachusetts, the Worcester State Lunatic Hospital. She was impressed by the humane and compassionate care the people there received, and she argued that everybody with mental disorders should have access to such care rather than being kept chained in jails. She wrote a lengthy report with these findings that she presented to the Massachusetts State Legislature. Now, of course, women were not allowed to address the legislature at that time, so she found some powerful male allies who would present her report on her behalf. The legislature, though it wasn't without a lengthy political battle, ultimately voted to accept the findings of the report, and the outcome was an increase by 150 beds of the capacity at the Worcester Hospital. Buoyed by this success, Dix began traveling to other states to advocate for reform. In each state, she followed the same pattern. She would visit jails and almshouses and record in intricate detail all the abuses against people with mental illness that she found in an extensive report. Then she'd develop relationships with male politicians who would lend their support and present her findings to that state legislature. Dix experienced tremendous success for her efforts. Many improvements and additions were made to existing facilities as a result of her efforts, along with the construction of approximately 30 new hospitals for people with mental illness in a variety of states. Whenever she had the opportunity, Dix also asserted her opinion when it came to the design and construction of the hospitals. She insisted that those who might be cured of their maladies have a therapeutic setting in which to recover, and that those who could not be cured be cared for in humane and comfortable conditions. Realizing that funding would be an ongoing issue, I think this is so visionary, she proposed a federal land grant of 12,500,000 acres be set aside as a public endowment for the future funding of care of people with mental illness. She lobbied for passage of this bill for 6 years, and eventually it passed both the House and the Senate in the United States. And President Millard Fillmore favored the bill and was prepared to sign it. Unfortunately, it did not make it to his desk before the election, and by the time it made it to the president's desk, Franklin Pierce was the president, and he vetoed the bill. Dix was so completely devastated by this loss. Unfortunately, more disappointment was in store for her as massive immigration into this country began to tax the facilities for the mentally ill she had worked so hard to secure. Toward the end of her life, she saw that the hospitals were overcrowded and understaffed, and that many of them were falling into disrepair. In fact, she could see that many of the terrible conditions she had seen in the jails were beginning to be replicated in the state hospitals. This knowledge was so depressing for her that she refused to speak about her work to anybody in the last years of her life. I imagine that if Dix could come to her research into conditions today, she'd be gratified by the advances in mental health care, while dismayed that some things have remained too much the same. NAMI reports that currently 1/4 of all adults in state prisons and 21% of those in local jails have a recent history of a mental health disorder. Amongst youth in the juvenile justice system, NAMI reports that at least 70% have one mental disorder, and amongst those, 20% have significant impairment from serious mental disorders. Too many people with mental illness still end up in jail. Now, I'm not saying that people with mental illness shouldn't be held accountable for their actions. What I am saying is that there are inequities in access to mental health treatment, and that those most at risk are too often unable to access the care that they need in order to help them stay out of trouble and lead satisfying lives. And it is possible for people with mental illness to lead satisfying lives. Key to realizing that possibility is early detection, adequate treatment, and supportive community. So that's where we come in. Dorothea Dix was motivated in her work by her faith tradition. She heard the Unitarian message about the importance of acting for the welfare of all people, and she took that message to heart. We can too. We can begin by educating ourselves so that we can help reduce the stigma against people with mental illness. And we can take one tiny little step in that direction right now. So I'd like to invite you, if you're willing, to raise your hand if you yourself are living with a mental illness or if you love somebody who's living with a mental illness. Take a look around. Noticing how many hands are raised, and knowing also that chances are good that there's probably a couple people in the room who aren't yet ready to raise their hands in recognition. So the numbers of those affected are even greater than it may seem. The point is that mental illness is something that affects many, many, many people. There's no reason for shame. Mental illness has some things in common with other illnesses, like diabetes and autoimmune disorders and heart disease. All of those diseases have an effect upon the choices a person will make about how they live, but none of them need to define a person's life. It's possible to live with mental illness and also find moments of well-being and contentedness, not in every moment. But no one has that sense of ease in every moment. Happiness, contentedness, well-being, whatever you choose to call it, is not a static state. It's more like a resting place that we have the opportunity to revisit again and again and again throughout the course of our lives. Part of what I think we're doing in this religious community is learning the way to that state, learning the way back to that state, showing other people the way to that state, creating the way, remembering the way, following the way that can take us there. May it be so, and amen. Once each month, we take a special collection for an organization whose work we'd like to support. Our special collection this morning is for the Love Light organization. Love Light is a local organization that has a primary mission of serving the needs of disadvantaged children in our community. One of the things that they do over the summer is provide hot meals for children who get free meals, free lunch in their schools, and who might not have access to nutritious meals over the course of the summer. They go around to various housing complexes and serve every single day during the week. And your contributions this morning will be given to support that effort this summer. BR is a religion which, like sunshine, goes everywhere. It's temple, all space. It's shrine, the good heart. It's creed, all truth. It's ritual, works of love. It's profession of faith, divine living. Go in peace.